two chapters in Genesis today. I'm not going to read through them straight. I'm going to read and stop and comment along the way. And at the end, if we have time, we'll see. We're starting a little bit later this morning. We'll maybe have an opportunity for questions and discussion as well. This is an exciting two chapters because mostly it's lists of names. But as in any genealogy, it's the exceptions to the list that are the exciting pieces and the things that will draw our attention, as we'll see. And there's sort of three genealogies in here, two or three, depending on how you want to count. The first one being chapter 10, and the second being the second half of chapter 11, with sort of an expanded version on Abram at the end of chapter 11. But for those who are, maybe this is your first time with us, or just for all of us, for sake of review, we're in Genesis. We've been there for a few weeks now. We've seen that God has the authority to pronounce things good because he made them. We've seen that God created the world and it was very good at the end of the sixth day. We've seen that sin does awful things. It destroys our relationship with God, our relationships with one another. It leads to death, and it continues from one generation to the next. And almost seems to snowball. I mean, it gets so bad that by Genesis 6, God says, I'm going to wipe this whole thing out, save one man and his family. But after that, God promised never to destroy mankind again with a flood. And all along, after the first sin, he had promised that the seed of the woman would one day bruise or crush the serpent's head. That was the first little hint of good news. And now, chapter 10 opens with these words, these are the generations. We've seen these are the generations used before to sort of introduce a section talking about a certain time period, a certain group of people. These are the generations of the sons of Noah. We just read about Noah, Shem, Ham, and Japheth, his three sons. Sons were born to them after the flood. Well, that answers that question, doesn't it? We're all like, well, is it only eight people? I mean, his kids were married. Well, all their children were born after the flood. And so we go. The sons of Japheth, verse 2. Japheth was which son? Oldest, youngest, middle child? Which one was he? He was the youngest. Why would we start off with the youngest? Why do you think the author would want to start off with the youngest first? I'm sorry? To end with the most important. Absolutely. It provides a crescendo. And in fact, we'll see that about Japheth and his sons, we have the least information. The sons of Japheth, Gomer, Magog, Madai, Javan, Tubal, Meshech, and Tiras. The sons of Gomer, Ashkenaz, Rephath, and Togarmah. The sons of Javan, Elisha, Tarshish, Kittim, Dodanim. From these, the coastland peoples spread in their lands, each with his own language, by their clans, in their nations. So, let's look at Japheth just briefly here, because he's the least important, least significant, I should say. But what do we notice about Japheth and his sons, about this genealogy here, this little section? I'm sorry?
They went to the coast.
They went to the coast, yes. Now, picture yourself in the Mediterranean. Remember, Moses is writing this for the Israelites, and so from their perspective, are the coastal peoples somebody they interact with a lot? They're kind of far away. I mean, we're talking Asia Minor, Greece, maybe as far away as Spain, that section of the Mediterranean area. So these are the people farthest away. They're sort of like, if your center of your world is Jerusalem, they're kind of around the perimeter. What else do we notice? They each have their own language? Well, that's hinting that something's going to be coming up here, isn't it? Because we know what happens in chapter 11, don't we? And we'll see. But at this record shows that each has their own language. How many descendants of Japheth are there listed?
Seven.
In the whole paragraph. I saw that being whispered by somebody. What do you make of 14? Do you think this is all he had? I mean, look at the... he has seven sons, right, listed. And then of Gomer, we see three, and of Javan, we see four. Do you think that Meshech, Tubal, Tiras, you know, they didn't have any? Magog didn't have any? I don't think that's the point, but the author wants to show there's 14 here. In fact, when we get to the end of the list, we'll see that there's a total of, some of you maybe know the answer already, 70. 70 groups, descendants, nations listed. That's going to be an important number later on. So we have the sons of Japheth. Now, the sons of Ham. Cush, Egypt, Put, and Canaan. The sons of Cush, Seba, Havilah, Sabta, Reama, Sabteca. The sons of Reama, Sheba, and Dedan. Cush fathered Nimrod. It's getting a little different now. This is one of those, here's a little something out of the ordinary. Yes, sir. Because they're listed elsewhere as Shem, Ham, and Japheth.
No, I was just looking at 24. It looks like he refers to Ham as the youngest.
I'm sorry.
And
you're right. Okay.
I'm sorry.
Yes. I'm sorry. But Japheth is the least significant, the least important is what I meant. Good catch. So we're in verse 8. Cush fathered Nimrod. He was the first on earth to be a mighty man. Now that's different. He was a mighty hunter before Yahweh. Now you'll see various people say that's a good thing or a bad thing. The name Nimrod means rebel. It tends to make me think it's maybe a bad thing. The beginning of his kingdom. Oh, we haven't seen a kingdom before, have we? I don't think so. So we have kind of the first king, and he's coming out of Ham and Cush. The beginning of his kingdom was Babel. We've read this book before, so we know where that's coming from. Erech, Akkad, and Calneh in the land of Shinar. From that land, he went to Assyria and built Nineveh. We've seen that name before. These aren't good places, are they? So we're kind of associating them with Nimrod. Maybe Nimrod's not so good of a person. We're not real sure, but it doesn't seem to be that way. Rehoboth-ir, Calah, and Rezin between Nineveh and Calah. That is the great city. Who else built cities so far? Remember earlier on, who else built a city? Cain built a city. Yeah, have any like of the good line built cities yet? No, so building a city is a little bit suspect at this point. Yes, yes. Yes, yes, the absolutely. And let's see here. What's significant about Babel and Nineveh? Those are cities whose people opposed God and his people. Yes. So, verse 13 now we're at. Egypt fathered Ludim, Anamim, Lahabim, Naphtahim, Pathrasim, Kaslaim, from whom the Philistines came, and Kaphtorim. What do you notice about all those? They all end in im, don't they? That's your Hebrew plural. These are not so much names as people groups that come from names. So that's one reason why this section, this chapter, is sometimes called the Table of Nations. As it opened up, or it says actually after every son, each with his own language, by their clans, in their nations. The point of this chapter isn't so much a genealogy as to list these are the 70 nations that the Israelites were aware of in their area and where their ancestry comes from. Sometimes they're listed as names of their ancestors. Sometimes they're listed as people groups, as they are in verse 13. Verse 15. Canaan fathered Sidon, his firstborn, and Heth, and the Jebusites, and the Amorites, the Girgashites, the Hivites, the Arkites, the Sinites, the Arvadites, and the Zemarites, and the Hamathites, and the Mosquitobites, and the... Oh, I'm sorry, that's not there. The Termites. Well, here's another way of looking at it. So we've seen the plural with the, you know, the Anamim and the Lebamim and the Naphtahim. And here we see the other way. We see these listed as people groups: Jebusites, Amorites, Girgashites, Hivites. Sidon, we've seen that name before, haven't we? That's a coastal city, Tyre and Sidon. Sometimes friendly with Israel, sometimes not. Heth. Now, Heth. Yes. I'd have to look more carefully, but im is actually a more literal plural from Hebrew words ending in im, is how they pluralize it in the Hebrew language, as opposed to these others, which are anglicized.
Okay. They're both the same plural.
They're both plurals. I'd have to look at a text and why one gets translated one way and one the other, but they're both plurals. You have cherubim. You hit familiar with that word? You have the single cherub, multiple cherubim. So that's, you could also say cherubs. So. All right. I'm glad that you all are interested in this, the details here. That's awesome. Here I thought this was going to go like... But you guys are digging in here. That's awesome. All right, so we are... Afterwards, the clans of the Canaanites dispersed. So now we're... See how we go along here, and we pick the people group, then we kind of narrow the focus, and now we're narrowing the focus even more on the Canaanites. Why would we focus on them? They're living in the Promised Land. Yeah. So Moses is making them, the Israelites, aware of where the people came from, who they're going to be invading and taking over. The clans of the Canaanites and the territory of the Canaanites, because now we're going to list that territory, extended from Sidon in the direction of Gerar as far as Gaza and in the direction of Sodom, Gomorrah, Admah, and Zeboim. See, there's another plural. And as far as Lasha, these are the sons of Ham by their clans, their languages, their lands, and their nations. So we've had Ham, we've had Japheth. To Shem also, the father of all the children of Eber. Now there's another little, it's not quite fitting the normal routine, is it? Eber. Well, that Eber, you ever heard of Hebrews? Eber, Hebrews? Hebrews get their name from Eber. He's their ancestor. So Hebrews is actually a larger group than just the Jewish people. But they are descendants of Eber, as we'll see. And so Abraham could take that as his people group, the Hebrews. The elder brother of... Shem also, the father of all the children of Eber, the elder brother of Japheth, Shem is, children were born. The sons of Shem, Elam, Ashur, Arpachshad, Lud, and Aram. The sons of Aram, Uz, Hul, Gether, and Mash. Arpachshad fathered Shelah, and Shelah fathered Eber. So Eber's obviously important because he's like listed right after Shem, and yet he's several generations later. And why is he important? Look, verse 25 answers our question. To Eber were born two sons. The name of the one was Peleg, for in his days the earth was divided. So that's going to be a question to be answered, perhaps. The earth was divided. And his brother's name was Joktan. Joktan fathered Almadad, Sheleph, Hazarmaveth, Jerah, Hadaram, Uzal, Dikla, Obal, Abamael, Sheba, Ophir, Havilah, and Jobab. He had a lot of boys there. All these were the sons of Joktan. In case we wondered, the territory in which they lived extended from Mesha in the direction of Shephar to the hill country of the east. These are the sons of Shem by their clans, their languages, their lands, and their nations. So if you look at the descendants of Shem, who's emphasized? Eber. Yeah, very much so. Because we don't see all the offshoots of all of everybody else, and his name's listed three times. When it's like, you know, three times, this is important. So, these are the clans of the sons of Noah, according to their genealogies in their nations, and from these the nations spread abroad on the earth after the flood. So we see nations mentioned there. Now we know why this is the table of nations. Big daughters weren't sources of nations. They gave birth, but the nations didn't take their names from the daughters, did they? They just took them from the sons. There must have been women somewhere, right? Lots of anonymous women here. Yeah. And it is interesting to note the absence of women's names, because early on the promised one was the seed of a woman. So we don't have any women mentioned here. Maybe that's part of it. None of these are the seed. We don't know the woman who gave birth to them. Maybe. Yes. Yes. The earth is divided. Yes.
So that there was a continent, that there was something.
That means something happened, but what happened? Well, you'll get people thinking maybe there was some kind of earthquake or tectonic plates were shifting. Or perhaps what happens in chapter 11 is what the earth was divided. Because it wasn't the land so much. And that's why people would argue it's an earthquake or some kind of thing, because they're talking land, earth being divided, not peoples. But, you know, okay, we can maybe think the only information we have is what's in chapter 11 that looks like at least the peoples living on the land are divided. Maybe that was it. Oftentimes they took names from significant events going on around them at the time. Yes, sir?
I apologize for being really rude there.
No, you weren't. You good, brought out a good observation.
Well,
my oversight.
About what you mentioned about plurals.
Mm-hmm.
I think like our language, we, you know, we don't say like mongooses, you know, it's like mongoose, or, you know, like, I wonder if it's always the same for like that. You know, because we say, you know, France is French.
Mm-hmm. Different ways of forming plurals. Is that what you mean?
Yeah, I was wondering if that was maybe some way they did it in Hebrew.
I'd have to look. Get with me right afterwards. I have a Hebrew text here. I'll look. But I'm not gonna pause for that yet. But yes, ma'am. Mm-hmm. Oh, we don't know. We don't know. It could be. It certainly would seem, maybe. And that's one of the... I appreciate you bringing that up, because one of the themes that we see throughout this section is, and we'll see it even more in the next chapter, getting to that seed of the woman, there are a lot of obstacles. And, you know, Noah doesn't have his boys until later than those, his ancestors, right? There's a big gap. And then all of a sudden, three show up. Maybe it was triplets. Sometimes when you wait later on, they come in multiple pairs, I'm told, even these days. And as we'll see in the next chapter's genealogy, you know, Sarai is barren. Well, that then Rebecca is, right? And then Rachel is, and all these obstacles get to that promised seed. It's like God's setting up, all right, the worst possible situation, and I'm going to get the glory because I'm going to get through it. Tells us something about God's capabilities. But yes, that could be another little hint. All right, there's this delay and then triplets, so maybe. But there is at least a delay in there. Some observations from this chapter, some additional observations. Mankind is multiplying. They're multiplying. And mankind is ruling. You have this hunter who's going out and doing what God said could be done, killing the animals and probably eating them. At least maybe feeding the population. Maybe he was such a good hunter, he could feed a lot of people, and so they clustered in his cities, maybe. God is waiting for the right time to have the seed of the woman come. It's not yet. Why is it not yet? Have you ever wondered, why didn't God just send Jesus right away? You know, could have had the Holy Spirit throughout all that Old Testament time. Well, he the writer of Hebrews in the New Testament says at the right time God sent his son. What made it the right time? We can speculate on that, but it's just an observation from the passage here. We have generation after generation. The seed's not come yet. The seed's not come yet. We're still waiting. Another observation. God is making many nations out of one, because that's the opening and closing conclusion, isn't it? Verse 32, these are the clans of the sons of Noah, one person. Opening, these are the generations of the sons of Noah. Ladies and gentlemen, we're all related. We're all related to Noah. We may not look much like each other. We may not talk like each other. In fact, all these people had different languages. But they were all related to one person. And that's a huge lesson from this chapter that's important for us. Later on, though, so God is making many nations out of one. But later on, we'll see him select one man to form one nation and then graft representatives from all these other nations into that one nation to make a new people. And that's how God's plan is going to work out. But at this point in time, he's spreading them out. So that's chapter 10. Chapter 11. Now we have a little story. That's fun. A little story. Now the whole earth had one language and the same words. So we're kind of backing up here, right? Because chapter 10 said all these people had their own language. So we're backing up and it's... We had this genealogy and now we're being... sort of like Genesis 1 and 2, right? We have this day 1, day 2, day 3, day 4, day 5, day 6... And then chapter 2, we have this little inset on day 6. Now we had in chapter 10, generation, 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 generation. And oh, by the way, here's a little story that happened somewhere in there. And it's going to be important to explain some things. Now the whole earth had one language and the same words. And as people migrated from the east. Now let me ask a question here. Who has an NIV? Megan, would you read verse 2 for us? All right, that's good. Now, yours is saying eastward, right? The ESV says from the east. Those aren't the same thing, are they? Our English translators are translating a word that very literally means from the east. Why would they pick for the NIV to say eastward? Why would they think that maybe that's what it's supposed... I mean, you could, it's very... Some very rare times you might translate, but it kind of means the opposite direction. Yes? Yes, the NIV does add that footnote. Yes. The NIV is translating this... We're looking at chapter 2, just the first phrase, as people migrated from the east, which is what the ESV and the King James both say, that kind of thing, from the east. But the NIV says toward the east a bit, basically, eastward.
Makes it sound like the flood didn't wipe out everybody, like it was like there's other people still alive coming to like meet up with Noah's nations and stuff.
Well, maybe. Maybe that could be... Let's look at east. We're only in chapter 11. Earlier in the chapters, what happens with the word east? Yes. That's chapter 3. Verse 24, he drove out the man, and at the east of the Garden of Eden, he placed the cherubim and a flaming sword. So it seems like he drove the man and the woman out to the east. What happens in chapter 4 with Cain? Verse 16. Yeah. Cain went away from the presence of the Lord and settled in the land of Nod, east of Eden. Going to the east is not a good thing. Why is it not a good thing? Because it's away from the presence of the Lord. The presence of the Lord was in Eden. Yes. That's going to be important. But that's why the NIV... thought that maybe a better translation would be eastward, because that's the wrong direction. And in this story, the people are going in the wrong direction, if you will. But I think from the east is important to interpreting this story. And we'll get to that now. They found a plain in the land of Shinar. We've seen that before, right? Who else was in the land of Shinar? Chapter 10. See, this is how they would read it too. They say, all right, there's a word here. I've seen it before. Let me go find it. Nimrod. Yes. Is Nimrod a good guy? No. So this is not a good place. Remember, Babel was, you know, all these bad cities were there. All right. They found a plain in the land of Shinar and settled there. And they said to one another, come, let us make bricks and burn them thoroughly. Good. What is that doing? They are literally subduing the earth, aren't they? They're taking earth and making it into something useful. Technology. Hey, we had a conference on that a little bit recently, didn't we? Technology is neutral. It can be used for good. It can be used for bad. So they're obeying that command to subdue the earth. But are they going to use it for good or for bad? Our hints so far are it's not going to be good. And they had brick for stone. Now, why mention stone? Remember who this is being written for. The Jewish people. What did they build their homes out of? Stone. When they got to the promised land, they built it out of stone. So they're saying, bricks are a building material. Like you use stone, they used brick. And bitumen for mortar. That's a kind of a tarry, pitchy thing. Then they said, come, let us build for ourselves a city and a tower with its top in the heavens, and let us make a name for ourselves, lest we be dispersed over the face of the whole earth. So this was what the people were trying to do. Build a city with a tower that reached to the heavens. Now, what does that imply about the tower? Is it just, it's a tower, it's going vertical. Yes, it's this heavens somehow, maybe it's going to be really tall, maybe they thought they could actually get there. Who's in the heavens? God. So they're trying to reach up to God, you see? You notice how they're moving from the east back in the direction of God? If he's in the west, that's where the Garden of Eden was. Now they're going vertical to try to reach up to God. See what they're doing here? They're trying to reach up to God on their terms and in their ways. It's not a good thing. Let us build for ourselves a city and a tower with its top in the heavens. Let's make a name for ourselves. Now, is it wrong to want a name for yourself? I'm sorry? Well, yeah. I mean, this is the first time I think we've seen sort of name for yourself mentioned, but it comes just in the next chapter. Somebody read Genesis 12, 1 through 3. There, I'll make your name great. Look at that. God said he was going to make somebody's name great. But these people are trying to make their own name great. See, that's not, we know that's not quite right, right? But is it wrong to want your name great? If God's going to make your name great, great. And they're going to, lest we be dispersed over the face of the whole earth. So they want to establish a city, kind of stick together. What are our thoughts on that? Is it wrong to want a city?
No, it's not wrong to want a city, but God told them to disperse, to scatter, so that they would be multiplying and fill the earth. They wanted to just stay in one place. They were disobeying God's order to scatter.
Well, they are multiplying. They're just not wanting to fill the earth, aren't they? They want to stay in one place. Is it wrong to want to stay in one place? Is there any city that God has promised to his people? A new Jerusalem, right? Doesn't come to the end of the book, but he hints about it a lot. So again, the people are seeking something that God is going to promise in his time, in his way, but they're trying to do it in their way. What this section here has to say about the people's attitude towards God is what's significant. They believe that God needs their help to connect with the earth. It's the tower that reaches to the heavens. Now, this is a little bit of bringing archaeology in, and there are some who are a little suspect with that. But if you go into Iraq and look at ziggurats, these kind of pyramid-like structures that are sort of like towers, and I mean, they're not like this, they're like this. They have an empty little structure at the top and stairs going up the outside. And the structure at the top is a place for the god to dwell and then come down to the temple that's next to it and be worshipped. They're saying the god almost needs help to come down. You know, they moved from the east towards God. They think God needs help coming down. They think they need to make a name for themselves. They need to establish a city for themselves, not waiting on God and his timing. So they're saying God's weak. God needs human help. They're also saying that we can help God. I mean, that's kind of the flip side, but it's a truism as well. They're able to build the bricks. They just work together. We can do it. They believe in themselves, don't they? That's a modern false gospel. And related to that is, if we can help God, then God owes us. You see, God needs our help. We can help him. And when we do, he owes us. And if he owes us, then we just have to do the right things and we get things out of God. See how that brings God down? That's what the people were doing. Without a proper understanding of God, they don't fear him. And therefore, God must... What's the solution to a misunderstanding of God? Now, we'll read what God does here, but at the end, let's ask ourselves, if people don't understand God, what can be done about that? So we'll continue with the story just to get the irony here. And Yahweh came down to see the city and the tower which the children of man had built. See the irony there? They're building a tower to the heavens, and it doesn't reach up high enough. God still has to come down. I can almost picture I don't want to bring God, make too much of a smallifying God, but I get this mental picture of a child, maybe about, you know, 7 or 8 years old, seeing a bug on the ground, maybe a ant hill or an interesting looking insect, and coming down to see what it's doing. That's what God's doing here. You know, the perspective is even bigger. Now, is God physically coming down? We know of his omnipresence, but that's what the author is trying to communicate here. Just this tiny little, they're the children of man. They're not people. They're little. Their efforts are small. God comes down to see what they're doing. And the Lord said, behold, they are one people, and they have all one language, and this is only the beginning of what they will do. And nothing that they propose to do will now be impossible for them. Now, is God saying that if humanity just unites, we can do everything together? No. Remember, they're sinful. All they can do is sin. He's not giving a general statement about the technological prowess of humanity. He's talking about their theological insights. They'll just go worse because everybody has the same language. Everybody's going to stick together, and it's only going to go bad. So what do? You break it up. What's the solution to pollution is dilution, right? Have you ever heard that before? I know some of us have. So he's diluting humanity. He's going to give them different languages and break them up so they have to disperse. So we don't have this concentrated bad theology going on here.
It makes me think of like when my kids are together too much and we have to give them each some quiet time.
Each go to your rooms.
And then they're nicer to each other. But I mean, they're just together too much.
Uh-huh.
And it doesn't work.
Yeah.
So you spread them out.
That's another appropriate way of looking at it. So that's the problem. Verse 7, come, let us go down, and there confuse their language so that they may not understand one another's speech. So Yahweh dispersed them from there over the face of the earth, and they left off building the city. So God accomplished his purposes, even though humanity was stubborn. It does say something about God and his power, doesn't it? Here they had all sorts of thoughts that they could reach up to God, they could help God, God would owe them, and God just goes, and they're spread out. So much for their ideas about what they could do for God. Verse 9, therefore its name was called Babel, because there Yahweh confused the language of all the earth. From there, Yahweh dispersed them over the face of all the earth. Now, interestingly enough, Babel more literally means gate of God. That's what they thought they were building, you see, a place for God to come to earth. But now it's being Babel as in confused. The author's having fun with similar sounding words meaning different things.
How long did all of this take?
We don't know exactly, and there's no time references. Even when exactly in the genealogy this happened, is that possibly that Peleg? Remember Peleg? The earth was divided. So sometime, perhaps, if you trace the genealogy out, because there aren't, in that previous table of nations, we don't have the, we'll see another upcoming genealogy that might help us place it, but we don't know exactly how long this is.
So was this like a instantaneous, they all spoke different things, or was it a different
fellow? The text doesn't tell us, but that this is what led to the dispersion. I mean, they're nomadic, or they're walking, they don't have jet planes, so it's taken a while for them to get places. And even as we look at migrations of people groups in other sciences, you know, they estimate, you know, the North America that came over the Bering Strait and then came down, all that takes a while. But this is the cause, that's the point here. Let me get that, yes? And fill the earth.
So what they did was actually they didn't care what God said at all. They were going to make a name for themselves, they were going to do it their way, and they were going to stay together. So at the end of this chapter it says, So the Lord dispersed him over the face of the earth, so he got his way.
Right. Right. In spite of their disobedience. Yes. Young.
I'm trying to, what you're saying about opposing divide,
mm-hmm.
Connected to the chapter 11.
Mm-hmm. Oh, some kind of geological problem during the dispersion? Could be. Could very well be. If you step back and look at Genesis 1 through 11, it sort of serves as an introduction to 12 through 50, and actually 12 through the rest of the Bible. It gives us categories from which to understand things. It introduces themes. We saw the theme of the problem of children. We'll see that a little bit at the end of this chapter as well. We've seen sin introduced. We get to know God. We've seen creation. And this story here about the Tower of Babel, does it sound like anything we've seen before? Remember the original fall in chapter 3? The couple decide God's not good, we're going to doubt what he has to say and do things our way, and they get sent away. The people here, we're going to do things our way, and what happens? They get sent away. So the disease of sin is very similar in the hearts of two people versus everybody, and the consequences are the same, being sent away. And we need a solution. We need a solution to this problem. We've had a hint of a solution, this seed of the woman, but it's not coming yet. So, chapter 11, verse 10. These are the generations of Shem. When Shem was 100 years old, he fathered Arpachshad 2 years after the flood. And Shem lived after he fathered Arpachshad 500 years and had other sons and daughters. When Arpachshad had lived 35 years, he fathered Shelah. And Arpachshad lived after he fathered Shelah 403 years and had other sons and daughters. And when Shelah had lived 30 years, he fathered Eber. And Shelah lived after he fathered Eber 403 years and had other sons and daughters. When Eber had lived 34 years, he fathered Peleg, and Eber lived after he fathered Peleg 430 years and had other sons and daughters. When Peleg lived 30 years, he fathered Reu, and Peleg lived after he fathered Reu 209 years and had other sons and daughters. And when Reu had lived 32 years, he fathered Serug, and Reu lived after he fathered Serug 207 years and had other sons and daughters. When Serug had lived 30 years, he fathered Nahor, and Serug lived after he fathered Nahor 200 years and had other sons and daughters. When Nahor had lived 29 years, he fathered Terah, and Nahor lived after he fathered Terah 119 years and had other sons and daughters. When Terah had lived 70 years, he fathered Abraham, Nahor, and Haran. So, just a few minutes here, but maybe we'll go a little long because the other thing went a little long, because we have just a few verses left here. What do you know about this genealogy? What do you notice? Anything stand out to you about this genealogy? What are you noticing? It's a long genealogy?
100 years.
Oh, they're living a long time.
Yes.
But it's getting shorter. Do you notice that? They're getting shorter and shorter. And they're fathering at a younger time. Except then Terah shows up and kind of blows that out, right? What else do we notice? I'm sorry, you were going to say something? No? Oh, yes, daughters show up. Yes, Eric.
They're only specifying the name of one of the sons.
Yes, that's there's they're showing the ancestors, how the Jewish people connect in with this table of nations and this overall line of Shem, which is, remember the blessing of Noah on his sons? Which son got the premier blessing? Shem. And there's also 10 generations. Is that something? There were 10 generations in the earlier genealogy from Adam to Noah. There's now 10 generations from Shem to Abram. Did you have a question, ma'am? Yes. 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 Absolutely. This is tracing the lineage of Jesus, and all you have to do is go to Luke's genealogy in chapter 3, and you'll see that it's followed there as well. Was there another question? Okay, so that statement of God that man's be 120 years, if that's talking about an individual person's lifespan, we're getting closer to that. Yes, and Nahor lived. that might be a way of understanding that. That there's other ways of understanding that as well. It could be there's about 120 years before the flood, but that's one option. So we've had that genealogy showing the connection from Adam to Noah, Noah to Terah, and now we have another one of these, and now these are the generations. So we know this is sort of a new chapter, if you will. It's at the end of another chapter, but these are the generations of Terah. Terah fathered Abram, Nahor, and Haran. We've just seen that, but in case you missed it. And Haran fathered Lot. Haran died in the presence of his father Terah in the land of his kindred in Ur of the Chaldeans. And Abram and Nahor took wives. The name of Abram's wife was Sarai. The name of Nahor's wife, Milcah, the daughter of Haran, the father of... Look at that. We've got a wife's name mentioned. She's going to show up later. That's why she's mentioned. Two wives, actually, Sarai and Milcah. The daughter of Haran, the father of Milcah and Iscah. Now Sarai was barren. She had no child. Little editorial comment there. That's going to be important information later. Terah took Abram, his son, and Lot, the son of Haran, his grandson, and Sarai, his daughter-in-law, and his son Abram's wife. And they went forth together from Ur of the Chaldeans to go into the land of Canaan. But when they came to Haran, they settled there. Oh, that's not the same Haran and his son. That's a different Haran. This is a place, that's a guy, and they're actually different spellings. They look the same as they're translated. The days of Terah were 205 years, and Terah died in Haran. Quickly, some observations here. Based on the last chapter, or the earlier part of this chapter, when there was this rebellion, really, against a right knowledge of God, God would have been fully justified to wipe everybody out again, right? But he didn't. He was gracious. He just confused language. He kept his promise of not sending a flood. And at that time, it doesn't seem like there was anybody. There was no Noah anymore. In fact, we don't have anybody who's faithful yet. These are all bad people. There's nobody following God. Not a Noah, even. Because Abram, Ur of the Chaldeans, They're pagans. In fact, Joshua brings that up at the end of his book in chapter 24. Your ancestors worshipped idols. Abram was originally an idol worshiper. And then God, I'm not going to steal too much from the next chapter, but that's happening now. We're seeing the characters. I just want to paint the dismal context in which we are finding ourselves at the end of chapter 11, so that when God shows up in chapter 12, we can be, yay! Okay? God will reach into the middle of this rebellious people and take one man to accomplish his purposes. God intervenes. God will intervene to bless families and nations, the ones that he has dispersed in chapter 11, and bless those nations through Abram, and ultimately through the son of Abram, Ham, Jesus Christ, who will be the son, the seed of the woman that's promised, and bring people from various languages and cultures together to worship God in heaven, in a new Jerusalem. Finally, everybody's together, what they've always wanted, but God's way in God's time, glorifying God so he gets the credit and the glory. And that's where we're heading. But at this point, at the end of chapter 11, things are rather dark.